Here to tell us what it says in Tuesday's papers is Fiona Kelly.
The Irish Times leads this morning with a story about how the absence of adequate home care inspection is making older people vulnerable to the risk of abuse and mistreatment. As concern regarding the inspection of Irish creches continues, Pamela Duncan writes that new reports on complaints over home help found cases of older people being left in bed because staff didn't show up, poor standards of intimate care and allegations of theft. 72% of motorists surveyed by the AA believe that there are fewer Gardaí on the road than this time last year. That's according to the lead story in today's Irish Examiner, which also reports that five people died on our roads over the bank holiday weekend. The Alan Shatter breath test controversy continues today in the lead story in the Irish Independent, which reports that the female Garda at the centre of the controversy is seeking legal advice on the incident which happened 5 years ago. The Irish Daily Star leads the story about how John Dundon was rushed to hospital following an 8-day hunger strike in Portlaoise prison. 29-year-old Dundon, who is due to go on trial today for the killing of Shane Gogan in Limerick in 2008. The Irish Sun leads the funeral of 23-year-old Dean Fitzpatrick, whose sister Amy Fitzpatrick went missing 5 years ago when she was aged 15. Today's Herald leads with a story about a school teacher who received a 3-month prison sentence for impersonating a Garda. 37-year-old Annette Bonner from Clonsilla in Dublin dressed in her housemate's Garda uniform and went to a local petrol station to buy petrol and groceries, which she was unable to pay for using her ATM card, but promised to return 30 minutes later. She signed the receipt in the name of her housemate, Garda Maria O'Hara, but failed to return with the money. The lead story in the Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, is about how a Garda unit was dispatched to a house in Castleknock to investigate an allegation that a man had killed a pet rabbit in his back garden after the rabbit had bitten members of his family. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Times reports that US Secretary of State John Kerry has called for an investigation into the unrest in Turkey on foot of reports of excessive use of force by the police following the fifth day of protests yesterday. Ask FM, the social media website which has been linked to cyberbullying and teenage suicides, which has 50 million users, has hired a public relations firm to repair its reputation. That's on the front of the Examiner, which also carries a story about how the Moorhaven Care Centre in Tipperary Town has apologised to a young woman with special needs who uses its service, who was mistakenly locked in a minibus which was left inside a garage for 7 hours. Yesterday's mini marathon in Dublin and the full-length marathon in Cork provide the pictures on most of today's front pages. The Examiner runs with a shot of 8-year-old Kieran Thomas with his mum Sarah, who ran the last half mile of the Cork marathon in memory of his father Leon, who died of sudden adult death syndrome just under a month ago while he was in training for the marathon. The Times has a story on its front page about how an increase in the number of students taking higher level maths in this year's Leaving Cert, which begins tomorrow, will result in an increase in the CAO points. But finally, The Independent runs with the front page story today about how the Department of Foreign Affairs has decided to sell off the most expensive wines in its cellar. The entire collection is worth just under €78,000, and from now on, visiting dignitaries will have to get used to drinking wines which are valued at under €30 a bottle.
Fiona, thank you. Brian Finn. Morning, Brian.
Gavin, thank you. Good morning. The Irish manufacturing sector remained in contraction for a third successive month in May, according to the Investec Purchasing Managers Index just published. However, there were signs of a return to stabilisation in the month. The rate of deterioration was marginal, coming in at 49.7, just below the break-even 50 mark. Output, new orders and employment all decreased at slower rates during the month. There was also a further easing in the rate of inflation on the cost front. They came a day after the PMIs for the Eurozone showed that the downturn in manufacturing eased somewhat in May, pointing to an improvement in overall economic performance in the month in the Eurozone and suggesting that another rate cut is less likely when the ECB meets later in the week. Irish-listed bakery company Arista has posted group revenue of just under €1.2 billion for the quarter to the end of April this year. That's up 0.2%. This is the group's third reporting quarter, and revenue to date for the financial year is standing at €3.2 billion, up just over 5%. Social gaming company Zynga, the company behind Farmville and Cityville, is to lay off 520 staff, or 18% of its workforce. It's reducing costs by around $80 million and is understood to be closing its offices in New York, Los Angeles and Dallas. The reason behind the cuts is largely the decline of its web business and the slow rise of its mobile business. Zynga set up its European headquarters here a few years ago, initially employing 50 people, but it later expanded, and it's not known if any of those will be affected by this move. Asian stocks were trading lower overnight on the back of weaker than expected economic data from the US and China yesterday, suggesting weakness in the world's two biggest economies. Wall Street was buoyed up by the figures, however, as expectations were reinforced that Federal Reserve Chief Ben Bernanke would keep the printing presses rolling at full tilt. There had been some fears in recent weeks that he would scale back on the quantitative easing program, sending stock markets lower in the process. On the currencies, the euro this morning is trading at just over $1.30 and a half and just above 85 pence sterling.
Days of unrest continue in Turkey. This morning as dawn broke, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Prime Minister's office in Istanbul. Many of them were told digging up pavements and hurling stones at riot police. Plans to develop a city park were behind the initial protests, but many are now talking about a Turkish spring, an uprising similar to the Arab Spring which swept the Middle East. Journalist David O'Byrne is in Istanbul this morning and he joins us now. Good morning, David. This talk of dawn disturbances, what's happening where you are now?
Well, where I am is quiet, fortunately, but the disturbances have been continuing all night in various parts of Turkey, in Istanbul, in a couple of areas, and also in the capital, Ankara, Izmir, I believe in Antalya, and also in Antakya in southeast Turkey, where we believe somebody was killed last night.
Is it growing?
It's difficult to say. It really is difficult to say. The media coverage from the Turkish media has been at best sparse. It's very difficult to get a complete picture as to what's happening. Most people, myself included, are relying on some news websites, which are sort of semi-official, not commercial websites, let's say. It is very difficult to get a complete picture as to what's going on, though.
We're reading about this left-wing trade union group coming in behind the protests, staging a two-day strike. How significant could that be?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. The KEF trade union called on a strike 2 days ago. It's not clear yet how many of their members have actually come out on strike or will be able to go out on strike. Generally, trade union called strikes in Turkey don't tend to have much effect. Trade union membership is not that high. But again, we'll just have to wait and see.
What is the source of discontent in Turkey? It's much more than developing a park, clearly, at this stage. What are people unhappy about?
It is indeed, yes. It started with the small park in Taksim Square, Gezi Park, which the government announced that it was going to redevelop as a shopping mall. Basically, if we look at the park itself, why would the national government be involved in redeveloping a park in the centre of a city that isn't the capital? It's the what people are unhappy with is the fact that the government seems to be trying to involve itself in every area of their lives. There has been new legislation brought in recently which severely restricts the sale and advertising and promotion of alcohol. Turkey is not a huge country in terms of alcohol consumption, but people do drink. And those people who drink feel that their lives are being impinged upon.
To what extent is the Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan a source of the issues which many people are protesting about?
I think he's central to them, basically. His public persona is not terribly sympathetic. He doesn't go to any trouble at all to try and present himself as a Prime Minister who listens to his own people. In fact, almost exactly the opposite. He seems to have been particularly recently intent on annoying as many people as possible.
Just tell us about the planned meeting between himself and the President this week. What is that likely to discuss? What's likely to come out of it?
Well, that's a good question. At the moment, Erdogan is in North Africa. He's visiting Morocco. He left Ankara yesterday. It's a strange decision to go off on a trip like this at such a moment. The trip was planned a long time in advance, but even so, these things can be cancelled, especially when there are so many street protests in your own country. We don't know what they'll talk about. Presumably they're going to have to talk about the protests. But what steps they'll take, well, we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay. Journalist David O'Byrne in Istanbul, thank you for speaking to us this morning.
Five people lost their lives on Irish roads over the weekend. That's 80 people so far this year, 11 more than this time last year. Two reasons named by drivers: less Gardaí on the roads and increasingly poorer roads. That's according to an AA survey today of over 20,000 drivers. Conor Faulkner is Director of Consumer Affairs with AA Roadwatch. He's in our city centre studio. Good morning, Conor.
Good morning.
This is a very large survey, and nearly three quarters of drivers are convinced there are less Gardaí on the roads, despite that being denied yesterday by a member of the Traffic Bureau to the News at One.
Yeah, it's a pretty unambiguous finding, isn't it? Only 8.5% of people disagreed. And as you say, it is a large sample of AA members up and down the country, over 20,000 of them. And it's spread. It's not just concentrated in the cities. So there's a good sample size there from every county in Ireland, and only a very small number of people disagreeing. So perception is everything. I don't necessarily want to criticise the Gardaí here, who are definitely on the front line. And, you know, road safety has been a victory for us of sorts over the last 10 years or so, Gavin. An awful lot of good work has been done, and I don't wish to sound critical of that, but perception is everything. We know from experience that it's flashing blue lights, it's the physical and visible presence of Gardaí that deters and that changes behaviour. And if it's perceived that slipping, well then I think inevitably road safety standards will slip as well. So it's absolutely critical that it's maintained.
Yeah, Gay Byrne, Chairman of the Road Safety Authority, quoted in yesterday's newspaper saying the general perception is that enforcement is no longer there, and once this happens, then the bad behaviour goes up. Why do you think there is that perception there if Gardaí are saying that there are no less Gardaí on the roads? Is it perhaps particular times of the day, particular roads? What's happening here?
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, there is some value, if rather limited, in seeing Gardaí during commuting times, for example, or on busy flowing roads where they're not particularly dangerous, but you will occasionally see a Garda holding out a speed detection device. There is some value in that because of its visibility. But I think much more than that, people actually want to see, and we know from talking to motorists, they want to see Garda alcohol checkpoints at 1 o'clock in the morning on roads that are used by people coming home having socialised. People want to be stopped and breathalysed. They actually will tell you about it afterwards, that they're pleased. Gardaí on the front line will tell you they get very, very good feedback from motorists when they stop them and breathalyse them. But it's got to be visible. Now, for example, Gavin, I think one of the strategies that concerns me is that the growth of the use of automated speed cameras, which are fine and do have their role, I think it would be disappointing if that automated enforcement began to displace the physical presence of Gardaí on the roads. It's not just a PR exercise, and I don't think we can count it in terms of the amount of fines that they collect. I think it's more profound than that. People have to believe that there are flashing blue lights out and about on the network at the times and in the places where danger exists. And I think if you allow that perception to drift, well, Gay Byrne said it perfectly and I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is a hearts and minds battle, and it's also a perception battle. And that perception is more important than the reality. So really, the dry stats that tell us whether or not, you know, the Gardaí have done X number of hours or Y number of hours, that's not particularly important. Whether people believe they're out there or not, that's the critical battle.
An even larger proportion of the people surveyed said the conditions of roads were getting worse.
Well, they are. I mean, there's no point in pretending that that's a facet of the AA survey or anything like that. I mean, they certainly are. We had over 80% of people felt that roads were deteriorating, and we know the reason why. I mean, the allocation of budget to repair and maintain secondary roads has been cut back drastically. It's only about €350 million this year, with perhaps a little bit more to be shaken out of the tree if Minister Kelly can manage it. But it's not enough. I think everybody acknowledges that that isn't enough even to maintain the current road stock and stop it deteriorating, let alone to make necessary improvements. And compounding the financial crisis, we had the one-off hit of 2010, where there were two severe weather events in 2010, and that did one-off damage to the road network. So that knocked us back. We've never really caught up with that, and we're not even spending enough money to maintain the roads we have, let alone improve them. So they're not like fine wine. They they do not improve with age. And every year that passes, when it's a year of underinvestment, it actually just means the road stock gets worse and the ultimate cost of fixing it becomes higher. So it's an ongoing frustration that we've been flagging to government for the last few years. They're actually spending less than is necessary to stop the roads deteriorating. And they've been doing that now for 3, 4, 5 years in a row. They cannot continue that indefinitely.
Conor, we'll be talking to Alan Kelly, the Transport Minister, later in the programme, who will no doubt cite the plan he put forward last week, a pilot scheme to allow local people to basically to help out themselves, whether it be through labour or money, to help repair local roads. But he's also going to be talking about a conference that's taking place in Dublin this week on intelligent transport and citing Ireland as an example of a hub of intelligent transport. What do you make of that claim?
Well, I mean, it's a very good idea. I'll be at that conference myself. It's the ITS conference at the conference centre in Dublin, and it should be fascinating. But we are actually quite a switched on nation in that regard. We're a nation of smartphone junkies. We use apps, etc. I mean, even a service like AA Roadwatch is intelligent transport, if you think about it. And we've been doing that here for 20 years, probably doing it better than anywhere else in Europe. So the connected motorist is perhaps a key part of our future. And we were talking about road safety. I mean, the safety implications for this technology are fantastic. I mean, already we're talking about with GPS units having in-car monitoring that will, in a sense, auto police, will report if you break speed limits, will report to your insurance company if you break speed limits. We can look at things like insurance paid for by the kilometre. So the connected car is a clear part of our future. And in the not too distant future, you might be driving down to Cork and halfway there get a phone call from the AA to say, you know, we've noticed back at base that something is happening with your car. Please pull in at the next service area and we'll see you there. So it's actually quite exciting in terms of the technology and how that can improve. And I think its road safety applications are pretty exciting as well.
Okay.
But I dare say we're still going to need blue lights. None of this is an excuse for paring back on Gardaí.
Conor Faulkner from AA, thank you. It's 25 past seven.
Appeals Court has ruled that the number of interviews contained in the controversial Boston College archive to be handed over to the PSNI should be reduced. A previous court had ordered 85 recordings be handed over. The Appeals Court has said just 11 should. The US Department of Justice has 1 month to appeal the ruling. Anthony McIntyre is a former IRA member. As an academic and journalist, he interviewed many people for the Belfast Project at Boston College. We spoke earlier this morning and I first asked him if he viewed the court ruling as good news.
Well, it's certainly news that is welcome, but limited. I don't see it as a victory. I see it and as minimising the extent of the defeat or the loss. The fact that anything would be handed over to British authorities is a loss, and nothing changes that.
These 11 interviews or recordings which are to be handed over, all of them, are we now of the belief that they are exclusively relating to the disappearance of Jean McConville?
Well, the court has ruled that there are references to Mrs. McConville in those interviews, and that therefore they are responsive to the subpoena as a result of that.
What about the McConville family, who up to now have said that this is only right and just, that they should be handed over? Are you beginning to turn to their way of thinking on this in any manner?
No, I am not. I mean, while I can understand on their position, I represent a different constituency, I represent a different ethic. I think that it poses a major threat to the ability of journalists and academics and researchers and historians to gain the type of necessary insight into the past, which will enable society to have a better understanding of that past. I think of it now, we now reach a situation whereby law enforcement shall tell us what the past is. We will get a very sanitized version of law enforcement's role in the past. Now, I think it's a very, very dangerous road to go down. I do believe that the McConville family and the rest of the families have that right to truth recovery. I don't see how we can oppose that right. The problem is that now there is going to be a massive reduction in the amount of truth that can ever be recovered because people will be fearful.
But this is a project which you yourself led, and these are assurances which you yourself gave to the people you interviewed.
Well, I I don't ever try to minimise my culpability, but the assurances that I give to the people were given only and exclusively on the basis of what Boston College instructed me to give. But I cannot deny, or nor do I wish to deny, my role in this, and I feel very, very disappointed in the outcome. But I behaved in a proper fashion. I give the undertakings to the interviewees at Boston College themselves had written up on their headed note paper.
Can I talk to you about these 11 interviews? A number of weeks ago here on RTE, Ed Maloney, who worked with you deeply on this project, said that there was the possibility that there could be other interviews with Dolores Price in this archive. Other interviews other than the interview you conducted with Dolores Price, which could shed light on the disappearance of Jean McConville. Is it your understanding that those other interviews could be part of these 11 now to be released?
The 11 interviews that the First Circuit has ruled on to be handed over are separate from the Dolores Price interviews. And that includes my interviews with Dolores Price. The interesting aspect in this ruling is that had Boston College appealed the initial Dolores Price verdict, they would have prevented her interviews being handed over, because in her interviews with me, there was no reference to Mrs. McConville.
On the issue of appeals, we spoke to Boston College last night. It said it would be reviewing the matter and considering all of its legal options before it responds to this court ruling. But the Department of Justice in the US could also appeal this particular ruling. Would you have a concern that could happen?
Well, I have a concern that anything that could be handed over, anything that weakens the case against handover, anything that strengthens the hand of the Department of Justice is detrimental and is not to be welcomed. And I do not know if the Department of Justice will put in an appeal, nor do I know if Boston College will put in an appeal. I imagine it would be difficult for the Department of Justice to argue to the Supreme Court of America that judges have no right to rule on subpoenas, that the justices in the court system are merely rubber stamps. And I think that the judge who wrote the verdict up, Judge Torello, was very strong in this. He slapped the Department of Justice down for having such an arrogant attitude.
Anthony McIntyre, one of the interviewers for the Belfast Project at Boston College. Darren is here with sports. Darren, the worst kept secret in the world is out, finally.
Yeah, absolutely. Fran, Jose Mourinho returning to Chelsea, and he says it wasn't an easy decision to return to Stamford Bridge. He signed a 4-year contract. Now he won't be formally presented until next Monday at a press conference. Frank Lampard, though, says his winning mentality makes him a special manager.
Yeah, I mean, he's taken out everywhere he's gone with him, and you know, he creates a spirit in his squads that you can see from the outside. It's very, very strong. So he's a top-class manager, we all know that. Very fortunate to have worked under him before. He took my game on a million miles and my personality in terms of football on a million miles. So, you know, a lot of the reason that I moved on in the game was because of him. So, you know, he creates a spirit in his squads that you can see from the outside. It's very, very strong. So he's a top-class manager, we all know that.
Yeah, we'll be hearing Jose Mourinho's thoughts on that move back to Chelsea on our next Sports Bulletin at 8:30. Also on the move, Roberto Martinez. It seems he's moved a step closer to becoming the new Everton manager. Wigan have reached an agreement with Everton over compensation for his services. Manchester City have agreed a deal to sign the Spanish international Jesus Navas from Sevilla. The 27-year-old winger will cost City over €20 million. The Irish amateur golfer Kevin Phelan has qualified for next week's US Open. He's a student at the University of North Florida, and he topped one of 11 sectional qualifying events across America last night. He finished on 9 under par after his 36-hole event. He qualifies for the US Open for the second time. He also qualified back in 2010 at Pebble Beach when Graham McDowell won it. Phelan is the son of Irish squash player John and he's lived most of his life in the US. Now, three of the four Irish boxers in action at the European Championships in Belarus yesterday lost, including Joe Ward and Ray Moylett, who were the defending their titles over there. The defeat particularly disappointing for Ward, who injured his knee in a freak accident 20 seconds from the end of his round. Afterwards, Kenny Egan spoke to him.
He's disgusted. He's lying up there in the bed with a cast around his leg, you know, but I just went in and, you know, I said the usual stuff, you know, hard luck. And, you know, he's only 19 years of age. He has the World Championships, please God, in October. Just not to, you know, to make any rash decisions. He has any amount of time on his hands. He just needs to rest now, you know. I suppose put the feet up. He'll heal fairly quick, 6 to 8 weeks, do you reckon, and then get back on the horse, you know. But he's really down himself. He really fancied himself to go out there and take that gold medal.
Yeah, really disappointing for him. There's five more Irish fighters in action today, all hoping to qualify for the quarterfinals. Paddy Barnes first in the ring around 12 noon. John Joe Nevin, Adam Nolan, Jason Quigley and Tommy McCarthy also in action. There are six internationals in the Western Four side to face the British and Irish Lions in Perth tomorrow. They have 54 test caps between them. The team will be led by Matt Hodgson. Brian O'Driscoll will captain the Lions in their first match on Australian soil. Conor Murray, Johnny Sexton, Tommy Bowe, Keen Healy, Rory Best, Sean O'Brien and Jamie Heaslip also in there. Rob Kearney, though, has emerged as an injury doubt for the remainder of the tour with a grade 1 hamstring tear. In the tennis, the first of the quarterfinals at this year's French Open take place today, and the pick of the game is the meeting of Roger Federer and Joe Wilfred Tsonga. Rafael Nadal celebrated his 27th birthday on court yesterday. He overcame Kai Nishikora and was then presented with a birthday cake, and the crowd sang happy birthday.
Joyeux
So Nadal is in the middle of the Philippe Chatrier court now, waving to all sides. There are sparklers for candles on this elaborate cake down there. And he looks very happy, although just a little bit awkward as well.
Yeah, just a little bit. I have to say, if you get a chance, Google the cake that he received yesterday. It was absolutely just ridiculous.
27 years old. He's almost a veteran now.
He is. He's still only lost one match, hasn't he, in
France? Absolutely.
Incredible record.
We're finally getting a summer here. In Central Europe, 2 months of rain have fallen in 2 days. Much of the Czech Republic, Germany and Austria is flooded and water levels are still rising. Let's go to the Czech capital, Prague, now, where river levels have got even higher overnight since several dams were opened in the south of the country. Ian Willoughby of Radio Prague is there. Good morning, Ian.
Morning, Gavin.
How bad is it there?
Well, actually, it's not too bad. The river management officials are saying that the flood level already peaked in Prague a couple of hours ago, and the volume of water passing through the city this morning was very high. It was 20 times higher than usual, but still things are not as bad as they might have been.
Can you move freely about the city? It looks from the pictures that we have seen here that a lot of the city looks like it's underwater. The metro is closed. It looks like a pretty miserable place to be right now.
Well, the metro is closed, I think, more for preventative reasons. The city centre is restricted, and the city is hard to get around. And for example, the schools have been closed in most of the city. I think perhaps for tourists it could be a problem if they're not used to Prague or if they're staying outside the centre trying to get around without the metro system. But it's mainly only the city centre around the river. The rest of the city is functioning quite normally.
Ian, we talked to you, it's over 10 years ago now, during the last really bad flooding in Prague and much of Central Europe, that there was an image at the time of an elephant who had been drowned in the zoo in Prague, just showing how bad it was. How does this compare with then?
Well, it's not as bad in general for a couple of reasons. One, there's less water, even though there has been a hell of a lot, and it's been like a monsoon here lately. The second reason is that they invested in the flood protection system. They put something like, I don't know, over 100 million euros into it. And what that means is that in particularly vulnerable parts of the city, say by the Charles Bridge, they can erect these temporary kind of panel walls. And they have proved effective, and so they kind of learned from the last time. And you mentioned the zoo. This time they evacuated the animals from the zoo in time, something like, I think, over 100 animals were moved. Or actually, no, it's more. It's 1,000. Sorry, over 1,000 animals have been moved, but they moved in time, and there have been no, well, apparently a flamingo broke its leg or something, but otherwise there's been no zoo disasters.
Is, in your view, is the worst over?
It is for Prague. It seems like it is for Prague. I mean, Prague is still on high alert, but there are places outside Prague, north of Prague. The river Vltava that goes through Prague flows north into the Elbe, and there are a lot of cities and towns on the Elbe where they're still evacuating people. They're bracing themselves for the worst. But I think in Prague, like I say, the water levels have culminated, and I think it will ease off, and I think we're over the worst of it.
Ian Willoughby in Prague, thank you.
An event showing how space activities and applications have a direct impact on our daily life opens in Dublin today. It's called the European Space Expo. Thousands of applications rely on space technologies, which help optimise transport, increase efficiency in agriculture and fisheries, and protect our environment as well. The expo is exploring all of that. Our reporter, Aisling Kenny, got a sneak preview of the Dome, which is located at Trinity College.
3, 2, 1, 0, booster ignition, and liftoff of Discovery, blazing a trail to scientific discoveries aboard space station.
The first thing you're going to see when you walk into Front Square at Trinity is the aliens have landed in Dublin, and it's this huge white dome. And once you pass inside it, you're going to enter space. And there's stars all over the sky inside the dome. You're going to see a big globe in the centre, which is the Earth. And then you can see pictures of Jupiter and so on.
That's Professor Peter Gallagher, a solar physicist in Trinity College and organiser of the Dublin Space Expo.
You're going to learn all about satellites. You're going to learn about the kind of stuff that Irish scientists are doing and Irish companies are doing, all about space. And some of it's weird stuff. Some of it's looking at the edge of the universe and trying to work out where the universe comes from. But others is much more practical. It's about looking at how do you navigate trucks across Europe? How do you land an aircraft in the Canary Islands when you're going on your holidays? How do you make that happen so that there aren't crashes or disasters? So it's a lot about the practical application of space.
So in the 21st century, are we always aware of how increasingly dependent we are on Earth orbiting satellites? The Space Expo has a number of interactive technology applications explaining exactly how satellites improve our lives.
AirPlus will make it possible to design flexible approach procedures for helicopters.
Pierce Buckley was among those who had a sneak preview of the event over the weekend.
It's interesting to see the technology being applied to aviation, for example, making it more efficient, reducing noise and reducing emissions on landing. It's also interesting how the technology allows helicopters, for example, to land where visibility is very poor, and improving the efficiency of transferring injured people to hospital, for example.
My name is Niamh O'Dowd. Well, I was just looking at, it's a program, it's called Copernicus, which is the Earth Observation Program. And they're using satellites, and they're looking at space and land and water and air, all of those things, and continuously monitoring them all the time, creating maps and data sets. And so from that, they're able to do a lot of prediction. I was just looking at, I was interested there in Venice, because we're hoping to go there, and they're monitoring it all the time and watching how the land is very slowly subsiding.
There'll also be a number of workshops running throughout the day for children and adults, including one which allows visitors to control a telescope in Tenerife and take pictures of the sun. Lorraine Hanlon is a professor in the School of Physics at UCD.
So the roof of the telescope in Tenerife is just opening there, and we can see the telescope is now turning to face the sun. It basically looks like nothing more than a yellow ball, and on which you can see these kind of black dots, which are sunspots. And sunspots are cooler regions of the sun's surface that show up slightly darker than the normal yellow we're used to seeing. And that gives us a way of monitoring solar activity in the sun by counting how many sunspots there are.
My name is Joseph Roach. I'm an astrophysicist here in Trinity College Dublin, and I'm the program manager for Space Expo Dublin. So when people come into the dome, they'll see a series of satellites hanging from the roof. Galileo is the next step, really, in global positioning. So at the moment, everyone around the world is very reliant on GPS, the global positioning system. But with Galileo, over the next number of years, Europe will be launching a series of satellites that we'll be able to use to pinpoint our location to within centimeters anywhere in Europe. The second program is called Copernicus. It's got real environmental applications in that we'll have it up there orbiting around the Earth and observing the temperature of the oceans and the levels of ice. So it should be able to give us instant feedback on a range of parameters, and something like tsunamis, we'd hope that we'd be able to see them coming a lot quicker than we would with our current systems.
That all sounds fun. The European Space Expo is free. It's visited 12 European cities and it's running at Trinity until Sunday. That report there from Aisling Kenny. Brian Finn is back with business.
Fran, thank you. Pharmaceutical company Elan has secured a High Court injunction against Royalty Pharma, temporarily preventing it from proceeding with its $6.4 billion takeover bid for the Dublin-listed firm. Royalty increased its cash offer from $11.25 per share to $12.50 per share 2 weeks ago, but Elan is telling shareholders to reject the deal. The matter is back in court in Dublin this morning. Now, staying in the pharmaceutical sector, an Irish startup company in the life sciences sphere has entered into collaboration with a prestigious Spanish oncology research centre to develop an innovative cancer treatment. Darren Cunningham, CEO of Inflection Biosciences, is here. Darren, this treatment you're developing, they're called kinase inhibitors. Tell us, how do they work?
Yes, thank you, Brian. If you look at the current treatments, the mainstay of treatment in cancer today, we've got the radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And while efficacious, these treatments are associated with side effects because they can't target just the tumour cells. They also damage healthy cells. So a lot of research in recent years has gone into targeted therapeutics, and kinase inhibitors have been very proficient at this. So if you look at very successful drugs like Gleevec, they've targeted certain kinases like BCR-ABL and have become very successful in generating revenues of around $4 billion per annum. In our case at Inflection Biosciences, the enzymes and the kinases that we are targeting are PIM kinases. PIM kinases have been shown to be overexpressed in numerous cancers. And so by addressing the overexpression, we can potentially treat the disease.
At what stage are you at? As you say, it's a fairly new and innovative form of treatment. So at what stage are you at with the development of this drug?
Well, we're quite lucky in that our development partner here, which is the CNIO, as you've mentioned, they've invested quite a significant amount of time into this program. So we are actually not too far away from selecting what we call a lead candidate for onward development. With the angel round that we have announced today, we are now able to complete the preclinical studies, which will allow us to tease apart the most promising programs from the portfolio that we have licensed. That should only take approximately a couple of months. And from there, we will need to raise further financing to take the lead program into IND-enabling studies and then into first-in-man studies.
Now, this collaboration with the Spanish National Research Centre, what does this enable you to do and what does it mean to your studies?
It's certainly a tremendous achievement for the company in that we get worldwide rights to develop a portfolio of small molecule cancer treatments. So with these worldwide rights, we now have the ability to build the company around this intellectual property. We can now form partnerships with other pharmaceutical companies as required, and we certainly look forward to raising the funds over the next while to progress those into humans.
Now, as you said, this is at a relatively early stage and you're looking for funding, particularly in the current environment. Is it difficult to find people that are willing to invest in something that's probably a fairly risky venture?
Well, that's correct, Brian. It's certainly a challenging environment out there now for all industries, including drug development. But it's certainly not impossible. And so with the right assets and the right data, there are definitely investors, particularly life science-focused investors, and we have a number of them here in Ireland and also internationally, who would be interested in early-stage drug development companies with attractive assets.
Now, from a cancer sufferer's point of view, again, to emphasise that it's very early stage, what kind of hope does this offer?
So drug development is a highly regulated environment, so there's a considerable amount of investment to go before these drugs could be available in the marketplace, so it's important to state that. But should these programs continue to show the promise that they have shown in preclinical studies, this could offer treatment opportunities for those currently not being treated in areas such as multiple myeloma, or various other forms of leukemia, as well as some solid tumour cancers like pancreatic cancer, where there remains considerable unmet need.
How long has your company been up and running now?
The company was actually set up only last year, although myself and my partner Michael O'Neill have been working on this for about 2 years. So this is a great achievement to get this far and have a licence of this calibre in the company at this point.
Okay, Darren Cunningham of Inflection Biosciences, thank you very much for that. Finally, the company Zynga has announced that it's let go of 18% of its workforce. That's the company that's brought us social media games such as Farmville and Cityville. And they're shutting offices in New York and Dallas and LA. On the currencies this morning, the euro is trading at just over $1.30.5 and 85.3 pence sterling, Gavin.
Brian, thank you.
A very good morning from that, Aaron. Well, with high pressure feeding in a continental easterly airflow, we are looking at a decent spell of summer weather now. Generally dry, warm and settled weather staying with us right up until the end of the week. In fact, good sunshine signalled with just gentle easterly breezes on many of the days ahead. Values all the time warmest away from the very east of Leinster and the south of Munster, with enhanced onshore breezes here. And just a word of caution, the UV index will be high now, especially in and around sunshine, with pollen counts mainly moderate at times high. As for today, well, it will be a dry day across most of the country with good spells of sunshine. Many areas, in fact, seeing unbroken sunshine, southern and eastern counties especially. However, there is a risk of a localised shower or two breaking out in the west and north later, and perhaps staying cloudier at times over Ulster. Warmer than of late, with afternoon highs ranging 17 to 22 degrees, with best values across the west and the Midlands. And as for tonight, well, it will be dry with long clear spells, but some mist and fog may develop with light easterly breezes. Lowest temperatures 7 to 10 degrees. And tomorrow Wednesday, another dry day and mostly sunny. However, a few localised heavy showers breaking out in the west and northwest. Thursday then, in turn, will be a dry day with good sunshine and light easterly breezes. Again, temperatures ranging 16 to 22 degrees. And a warmer day on Friday with values rising anywhere from 17 to 23 degrees. Most areas dry and mostly sunny. Today in brief, most areas dry and sunny, but cloudy at times over Ulster, with temperatures on average coming in around 20. That's your forecast. A very good morning.